Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. My guest is Ken Bensinger. He's here to talk about his new book, Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. It's available everywhere now from Simon & Schuster. Ken's an investigative reporter at BuzzFeed, formerly with the Wall Street Journal, among other publications. And this book tells just an incredible tale of a scandal that led to scores of individuals and companies associated with professional soccer and the international governing body, FIFA, being brought to justice. Ken, with FIFA being the international soccer governing body, it's not a government entity, and so they're really not answerable to anybody. It kind of reminds me of these boxing governing bodies within the states, like Nevada Boxing Commission. Is it even possible to oversee organizations such as FIFA?
That's actually, right off the bat, you're going right to the heart of it. How do you regulate an NGO that's got international reach, the boxing organization, not just the Nevada one, but think about the WBO or the IBF in the boxing world, or how about the International Olympic Committee is another one. They all are these organizations that sort of exist outside of the government realm, and as a result, sort of have some of them, like FIFA or like IOC, have come to believe that they are almost above government control, but they don't. No one can regulate them. And one of the things I discovered working on this book, which I thought was fascinating, is that there's something like 5 dozen sports organizations that are based, international sports organizations based in Switzerland, including FIFA and IOC, but also International Basketball Federation, volleyball, hockey, sort of you name the sport, and it's based there. And the reason is because the Swiss have proven to be incredibly loose regulators. They're not interested in charging a lot of tax, and they're certainly not interested in making people make their books open or do anything for transparency. And it's great for these organizations, but it has given them all a sense of impunity that they can get away with murder. And in the case of FIFA, what they were getting away with was a culture that was basically based on corruption from top to bottom that's been developing for more than 40, almost 45 years in that fashion.
Well, the scandal, it really broke. I mean, it broke a little bit before this, but British Prime Minister David Cameron, Prince William, and David Beckham were all lobbying FIFA in Zurich around 2010 to try to secure the 2018 and 2020 World Cups. Turns out Russia had already bought and paid for the event. How did this come about in basically secrecy?
Yeah, so move us back to 2010, and there's a vote scheduled for December that year to determine who's going to host the 2018 World Cup, which we are now seeing, of course, ends up in Russia. And competing with Russia was Spain and Portugal, who had a combined bid, Holland and Belgium, who had another combined bid, and finally England. And by everyone's reckoning, England was the best candidate. They had the best soccer history, they had the best stadiums, the best airports, the best infrastructure. England was really a great place to hold the World Cup. But Russia wasn't really interested in winning the beauty pageant. They were interested in winning the down and dirty way. And while England was running around with the Camerons and the Prince Williams and the David Beckhams, Russia was running around behind closed doors and making kind of sketchy deals. And England shows up in December thinking they've got this in the hand, and instead out walks Russia, the champion. And Vladimir Putin flies immediately into Zurich as soon as the vote's over. And to celebrate the big victory and bask in the glory of it, which he does. And there are lots of suspicions about what Russia did to do it. I mean, for example, there was one voting member of FIFA who admitted to receiving a painting from the Russian bid, but he claimed that was okay because the painting was quote-unquote ugly. There was other members who were accused of receiving a Picasso and other things, and there was gas deals and giant infrastructure deal that allegedly might have been happening to get people to vote one way or the other. But in a very contemporary twist in the whole story, we'll never know, because when FIFA, a couple years later, sent lawyers to investigate what happened in the bid to Russia, they were told that all the computers that Russia had used for the bid had been destroyed, and there was no evidence, no records, and no books whatsoever from the bid to tell people what had happened. So there's literally no paper trail. We'll never know what happened.
It's kind of ironic that the prosecution and this whole thing kind of came crashing down based upon American authorities, because as far as the way people care about soccer, America is probably on the bottom of the list with countries that care about soccer. But nonetheless, Chuck Blazer, really, he's a native of New York and a large fellow, but he became a central figure in your book and the scandal. And basically, without his cooperation, this investigation probably wouldn't have gone anywhere. So what was his role?
Yeah, you're right. He's a very interesting character. He's the probably, without question, the most powerful American soccer official ever. And you're right, this is not a very popular sport in this country. And for Americans who have spent any time abroad, they understand. But for Americans who haven't, it's hard to understand how important it is elsewhere. And the best example I can think is if you took the National Football League, National Hockey League, Major League Baseball, and NBA, and sort of squashed them into one thing, that's what it would feel like in every other country, soccer. That's all the people care about, and they're obsessed with it. And Blazer was incredibly powerful, the most powerful American figure in the world, one of the 24 most powerful men in the sport on the FIFA committee, executive committee. But in the U.S., he was an anonymous figure. No one had ever heard of him. And he enjoyed that sort of duality of being powerful but not being well-known. And that led him to be, like so many FIFA officials, very confident that nothing could ever touch him. But his downfall, and this is a guy who was skimming millions of dollars from the sport, who was taking bribes left, right, and center, and was writing sort of these incredibly self-dealing contracts that would benefit only him and to the detriment of the sport. But his downfall was he didn't pay taxes. To avoid declaring all the income he had, he never did file taxes. And as a result, in 2011, when the case was about a year old, the IRS and sort of stagnated. An IRS agent out here in California did some digging on him and found out he didn't have any tax information, had never filed taxes, and then went a step further and proved that he had income, at which point he cornered Blazer, and they basically gave him a choice, either cooperate or go to prison right away. And he decided to cooperate, and as you said, critical, because he became the tour guide. He became the guy, the native of that strange land, who could take these law enforcement agents, FBI and IRS agents, around the FIFA world and teach them how it worked and show them how the bribes worked and how complicated these different systems were and how people washed their money. And then he also went one step further and agreed to wear a wire and secretly record conversations with other soccer officials to help build evidence against them as well.
Well, the investigator from the IRS, Steve Berryman, he played a role in here too, and he was able to get banking records essentially from different places around the world without a subpoena. He traced these international money transfers. How did he accomplish this without a subpoena?
Well, he did it without having to subpoena any banks outside the country. He did subpoena banks within the country, but the advantage of subpoena banks inside the U.S. is that those banks have to comply, and they also are not allowed to tell their client that their records have been subpoenaed. So this was one of Steve Berryman's genius tricks, was knowing how he could trace money coming in and out of American banks in a way that would show him information about FIFA bribes without the account holders ever being the wiser. And he and the prosecutors were worried that if they ever subpoenaed, for example, banks in Switzerland or Brazil or places where the bribe activity was happening, then the first thing that would happen would be that those banks would contact their clients and the jig would be up. So what Berryman knew, and this is a guy who had spent most of his career of doing public corruption cases in California and also doing Mexican cartel drug cases in California, what he knew was that wire transfers all around the world, including between two countries that have nothing to do with the U.S., very frequently come through U.S. banks anyway. The middleman banks that facilitate these transactions, which are known as correspondent banks, are based in the U.S. almost always. And once he knew that, all he needed was a tiny toehold to begin subpoenaing the middleman banks, the correspondent banks, for any information about these different officials. And that allowed him to it's sort of like a Pandora's box. He opened it up and could find out all the dirty laundry of hundreds of soccer officials without them ever being the wiser.
I'm chatting with Ken Bensinger about his brand new book, Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. It's available from Simon & Schuster. We're talking about the FIFA scandal, of course, in the international soccer governing body. Ken, something else that I found interesting when I was reading this book, and I guess it's a self-fulfilling question, because I know it's a white-collar crime. Usually those are boring because they involve all kinds of just weird, all kinds of things that, you know, people don't understand. This wasn't that complicated of a scandal when it got down to it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it seems, well, it's sort of, there's complications in the following the money trail, right? But where, you know, from point A to point B to point C, and all of a sudden you go 38 points before you get to point Z. So it's complicated in that sense, but conceptually it's not complicated, right? We think about white-collar crime, like, you know, if you think about the stuff that happened with the stock market, the mortgage market, and all the stuff behind the story of The Big Short that we saw a few years ago, it takes you, you know, four or five tries to really wrap your head around what they mean by, you know, what a derivative is and what's a synthetic CDO and that sort of stuff, right? And it's hard to understand how all that stuff works. And I think, in fact, the complexity of those schemes was what led to them being criminal and also what led to people being defrauded by them. With the FIFA stuff, it wasn't complicated in that way, right? This is basically bribes and kickbacks to people so that they would give marketing companies and their partners contracts for broadcasting and for sponsorship at below market value, and the official gets the bribe to do that. That's basically the heart of it, right? And when it comes to the voting within FIFA for World Cup sites, it's even simpler. It's just, I'll pay you money and you vote the way I want you to vote. It's as simple as that. It doesn't take much more than like a third grade education to understand that stuff. The complexity of the case is more just breaking it open and actually seeing where the money went.
Were there jurisdictional problems for the prosecution here?
I think that that was an initial issue and something that prosecutors considered from the get-go, was how do we get jurisdiction in this case and make it stand up? In the end, when they had a trial in November and December last year, the judge completely endorsed their jurisdictional theories and didn't give them any trouble at all, despite, you know, objections from the defense. But to get there, they had to think about it. And what they realized was that stuff we were talking about earlier with the correspondent banks was the first step to giving them jurisdiction, because a massive percentage of all of these bribes were going through the U.S. Banking system as on their route towards, you know, people's pockets. And so that put it in the U.S. And then it turns out that a lot of the dirty dealing was happening in the U.S. anyway, because of people like Blazer. There was an American in Miami that was involved in stuff, and one of the corrupt firms was based, there's actually several of the corrupt marketing firms were based in Miami conducting, arranging corrupt deals out of Miami. So that led to it. And then it turns out that there's a huge culture of soccer corruption in Miami anyhow, where people are coming into Miami to make these deals. So there's actual, you know, taped recordings of, secretly taped recordings of soccer officials in restaurants and hotels in Miami making corrupt deals. And so with all that, they were able to establish jurisdiction. And they also sort of went the extra mile and got some of their cooperators to bring people to New York's Eastern District, which is where this case was centered from a legal point of view. So that's Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island, et cetera. They actually got people to travel to New York and do things to commit to crimes within their specific jurisdiction to cement the fact that it belonged there.
Just from a purely philosophical standpoint, how is paying bribes through FIFA different than a political donor making a donation to a candidate and later getting some benefit in the form of favorable legislation?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, you know, in other countries in the world, they think that system that we have in our country of lobbying and donations and all that is in itself a kind of corruption. And here we think of it as free speech protected by the First Amendment, I know, but in many parts of the world, they find that kind of shocking. So but I think it's an interesting question, but I think that the answer, the legal theory that the prosecutors came up with to show why that's a problem is because these officials of FIFA were essentially owing a fiduciary duty to FIFA, and also were signers to the various ethics codes that the different football soccer organizations had, right? The FIFA code and the code of the national federations and the codes of the regional confederations they belong to all prohibited taking bribes, all prohibited different kinds of activities, including not acting in the best faith toward the organization. So what the prosecutors argued and showed was that by taking a bribe, they were breaking the ethics code, and they were also depriving the organization of money that really belonged to the organization in the form of the bribe, and failing on a fiduciary level, because by accepting the bribe, they were also signing off on contracts that were below market value, and therefore cheating the organization out of further money.
Now that the prosecutions have yielded all these convictions and things like that, what is there still any oversight of FIFA, or do they just go back to business as usual?
I mean, I think it's not quite business as usual because they've taken in the teeth. You know, they've had massive financial losses because of this. A lot of the sponsors abandoned FIFA, and the lawyers arrived in droves demanding huge, huge fees. So FIFA, for the last few years, has been in the red after decades in the black. So they felt the pain financially, and they've instituted some changes, some reforms. They've changed their voting procedures for World Cup siting. So it's now the entire Congress of FIFA, all 211 nations, rather than just the executive committee. They've given women a much larger role in FIFA than they ever had before, while still a vast minority. At least there are some women on the executive council now. And they've taken what you might think of as baby steps towards an improved governance. But it still remains an organization without a regulator, without anyone outside minding the fort. And I think for that reason, and for the fact that people around the world are still obsessed with the sport and will do anything to watch it, there's still a real problem that there's no one to stop people from finding new and quieter ways to take bribes. One of the stories I heard from people in the immediate aftermath of the big U.S. arrest that opened this case up to the public in 2015 was that all the soccer officials changed their behavior. They just stopped taking bribes in dollars and started taking bribes in euros, because they knew that way the bribes were much less likely to go through American banks.
So you may get a sequel to this book in 20 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, 20 years. Well, sure, why not? I mean, it's an interesting topic, and maybe the next time I'll actually get to go to the World Cup. I think that's a good plan.
All right, the book is Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal by Ken Bensinger. It's available now wherever your books are sold from the good folks at Simon & Schuster. Ken, just a fantastically entertaining book here. It read like a mystery to me, and I just loved following it. Thanks for putting out a great story here on a level that all of us can understand, and thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it was a great pleasure. Your questions were terrific, and I really had a lot of fun talking to you.
Thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.